delighted this morning to welcome on behalf of the court the Heritage Christian students who are part of our Court with Class program today. Would they please stand? Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. Please be seated. I'd now like to introduce the court to all of you. And on my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to my left, Justice William Babbage, Justice Jeanine Geske, and Justice Patrick Crooks. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. The Heritage Christian students will meet with Justice Crooks in the courtroom immediately at the conclusion of the oral argument today, and he will be talking with you about the procedures of the court and answering your questions. With that completed, I will call the case for this morning, 96-1158, State v. Chrysler Outboard Corporation. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Cynthia Hirsch, who will, according to my notes, appear for 15 minutes, and then Shari Eggleston, who will appear for 10. Ms. Hirsch.
Good morning. I am Cynthia Hirsch, Assistant Attorney General, and I will be sharing this morning's arguments with Assistant Attorney General Shari Eggleston. We both appear on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. I will discuss the statute of limitations, and Ms. Eggleston will discuss the hazardous spills law issue. The state is seeking both injunctive relief and civil forfeitures on both claims. In late 1992, more than 455-gallon drums were discovered and eventually excavated from a construction site in the village of Heartland. Approximately 240 of the drums contained hazardous waste, and virtually all of the drums contained paint and solvent waste that came in the early 1970s from the Chrysler Outboard Corporation plant in Hartford, Wisconsin. Chrysler had hired unlicensed haulers who transported and buried the drums at the rural Heartland site. In late 1992, the state first learned of the illegal disposal and the widespread soil and groundwater contamination which resulted from the buried waste. It is because of the threat to public health from this type of serious groundwater contamination, and because the very intent of Wisconsin's environmental laws is to protect our important environmental natural resources and the citizens who depend on them, that the state is asking this court to extend the Wisconsin discovery rule to this environmental enforcement case. While it is true that we're asking the court to apply the discovery rule in a way in which it has not been applied previously, this request is not without substantial support from this court's previous rulings, and public policy. This court already took the important step in Hansen, Borrello, Spittler, and other tort cases and determined it was unfair to time bar a plaintiff's claim when the injury was not even discovered until after the limitations period expired. This court fairly balanced the plaintiff's right to a day in court against the defendant's right to be protected from stale claims and found that both are concerns of justice. Just as in the tort context, the case at issue today involves a substantial injury to the plaintiff, the state, that was literally buried under the ground long past the statute of limitations expired because of the defendant's failure to follow the law in the early 70s. Had the defendant seen to it that its waste went to a licensed landfill, which was the law in the early 70s, the state could have known of the contamination long before 1992. Just as in the tort cases in which this court has decided a discovery rule is fair, the injury was latent so that a reasonable person could not have discovered it within a given statutory time period. This court has also recognized that discovery of the injury often leads to essential elements of a cause of action, the identity of the defendant and the cause of the injury, which is also the case here.
Have we ever had a case on discovery that didn't have a personal injury element in it?
There has not been a case in Wisconsin that is not a tort case in which the discovery rule has been applied.
Well, isn't it even narrower that it was always a personal injury?
I believe that's correct. I believe all of the applications of the discovery rule in Wisconsin have been to tort cases involving personal injuries. And we are asking the court to extend the case here because there is an injury, and that injury is to the public. It is an injury to the environment, and it is our argument that the penalties we are seeking and the remedial action that we are seeking are like damages. The state needs to be made whole.
How also you placed, seemingly placed emphasis on the fact that when the when these barrels were disposed of, they were engaging in an illegal act.
That's correct.
Should that make a difference? What if this was not illegal at the time?
If it were not illegal,
it's simply negligence.
If it were a negligent suit, then it would be a private action, and I suspect the discovery rule would apply. It was illegal at the time, which is why it was a violation of the laws that were in effect at the time.
What was illegal about it at the time, giving it to an unlicensed transporter?
The laws in effect at the time required Chrysler to either hire a licensed transporter or see to it that its waste was disposed of in a licensed landfill. It did neither.
What effect, I understand a lot of this is public policy, would this have, Wisconsin is a farming state and you have a lot of people who perhaps disposed of batteries or other deleterious items in a washout on a farm. How would that affect the discovery rule, that community, when it may have not been discovered for 30 years later and there may have been two or three subsequent owners?
Well, first of all, this would only apply in a situation where the violator was violating the law that was in effect at the time. And in this case, there's evidence in the record that shows that Chrysler knew that these were violations.
That's important that you must know that there was a violation. It must be intent, you knowingly, you intentionally violated.
I think all the components of the violation have to be there, and in this case it's true that Chrysler knew there was a violation. Also, I'd like to point out that the discovery rule includes the caveat that the state, if it is applied in this case, not only that the state knew of the injury, but the state should have known of the injury. And that should have known puts a heavy burden on the regulatory agency to be on top of what's going on. If the regulatory agency has an ability to be out there in the community, it has a lot of regulatory arms, and there are a lot of possibilities in which the state would have known of the buried waste.
I'm not satisfied with the answer that you gave me to the question, or maybe you didn't understand the full import of it. Many of the cases, I think almost all of them, dealing with the discovery rule, deal with negligent acts, do they not? And that the negligent act was not discovered until after the statute of limitations had run?
The current Wisconsin tort law cases deal with negligent acts.
What I'm asking, I guess, is whether you are asking us to say, to hold in this case a very broad general principle that environmental damage, that the statute of limitations does not apply to environmental damage until it is discovered, regardless of the cause, regardless of whether the act was intentional, unintentional, illegal, or not legal. What are you asking us for?
I'm asking you to apply the discovery rule to violations of environmental law, particularly this environmental law in this case. There's a violation of an environmental law. The injury is not discovered until 1992. We're asking that the statute of limitations not run until the injury is discovered. And I'd like to add to my answer. Defendant places a lot of emphasis on a D.C. Circuit case that was EPA versus 3M. In that case, the federal court declined to apply the discovery rule to 3M's violation. And I think the federal court had a problem with what EPA was asking for, and I think this might go to the heart of your question. In that case, EPA was really asking that the statute of limitations not run until they've discovered the violation, until they've been able to put together all the pieces of the violation and are able to actually bring it. And I think the EPA's reasoning is that because of the way the federal law works, they had logistical regulatory problems in learning about the violation. I think the federal court did not want to treat EPA and give EPA a special pass on the statute of limitations that it would not give to private litigants. We are asking for exactly not that special
pass. Let me ask you a follow-up question. One of my concerns is that although you may be asking for the extension of the discovery rule only to the environmental rule, it seems to me you're asking for a much broader rule. That is, that in a forfeiture action brought by the state, that until there is a discovery of the injury or maybe the illegal act or all the elements, that the statute of limitations not begin. And I have a hard time, I guess, thinking where else that might apply, but I was thinking, for example, if a company had illegally put asbestos into their walls, you know, 30 years ago. There was some regulation that they shouldn't have done it the way they did it. They now do it, and the district attorney's office wants to prosecute them criminally, but they can only be fined because they're a corporation. And there's a statute of limitations. It seems to me that the rule you're asking for would also extend the statute of limitations for those acts. And I mean, there are a myriad of forfeitures out there, and I don't know all of them, but it seems to me that if there are those kinds of acts that may have had an illegality or at least not approved under regulations a long period of time, and there's sort of a latent injury that occurs, the rule would apply to all those other situations as well. And I don't know how we would draft a rule that would simply say just on environmental cases.
I think, first of all, the discovery rule is always applied on a case-by-case basis, and we're asking you to apply
it. Well, but it's been applied to personal injury. I mean, if you have a personal injury that falls under Hansen and Borrello and those kinds of things, it's not a case-by-case. It's all those kinds of tort cases where you don't discover the link between the injury and the negligent act until a later time.
We're asking you to apply it to this case because there is an injury, and we really are asking...
You know, we don't write a case just for your case. My concern is the broad effect, and I want you to address how it is we write a rule that would just apply to this case and not to those other situations, other kinds of forfeitures that may have the same sort of elements, that is, some act that was performed and perhaps not legal at the time, has some kind of statute of limitations, and the regulatory agency, i.e. the state, didn't discover it until later, and that they reasonably couldn't have found it until later.
I believe I understand your question, and I think I can answer it. And the answer is, this truly is a discovery of injury rule. If there is an injury that's discovered, then we're asking that the statute of limitations not run until that injury occurs. Once we know once we discover that there's a drum in late 1992, that's the injury.
Well, let me ask about the asbestos case.
Yes.
Some workers start developing lung problems 40 years after the incident, and they're now linking it to an act vis-a-vis the asbestos placement 40 years ago, and let's assume that there's some statute or forfeiture that covers that. Wouldn't that fall under the same rule?
I think it might. I think the court would apply it in this way. When the injury to the workers is discovered, the statute runs. If it then takes the regulatory agency 6 months, a year, 2 years, to figure out who the violator is or where the violation
takes
place.
Injury to person and injury to property you're asking for, right?
In this case, it's an injury to property.
Which is, as I voiced earlier, so it's injury to person and injury to property.
Right. I think what we're asking is for the regulatory agency, in this case DNR, but you're right, it could be another regulatory agency, to be put in the same position as a private litigant, so that if an injury is hidden or buried, whether in the case of the asbestos worker or in the case of buried drums, it's not until that injury is discovered that the statute begins to run. We'll put together the violation within the appropriate time. We're not asking...
The extension is not only put you in the same place, because if you were just asking for damages, tort damages... In a personal injury case, you'd be in the same place. I mean, I think that clearly that would be extended. You're asking that it be extended to a forfeiture kind of action.
That's right. And these are... I'm sorry?
An injunction and remediation.
That's correct. And these are civil penalties, and it is our position that both the penalties and the injunctive relief are like damages. They make the state whole. And in fact,
Let me interrupt and ask you, if we were to extend the discovery rule, why should we not draw the line at remediation or at injunctive relief? Why should we go so far as civil sanctions as well?
Because civil sanctions not only deter further violations of the law, but in the case of environmental damage, the remedial relief often does not make the state whole. Often groundwater cannot be completely repaired. and the penalties are damages to the state for permanent damage to the environment.
Aren't penalties punishments? I mean, it seems to me, 3M says that, that remediation is the remedy for making the state whole, that the purpose behind penalty is punishment.
I think that's one of the purposes behind penalties, but as I said, I think penalties also serve as damages because groundwater can never completely be restored. Remediation is not always an option in an environmental case. It's not always possible.
What authority do you have to cite the proposition that a penalty is commensurate with damages?
In my brief, I cited two U.S. Supreme Court cases, U.S. v. Halper and U.S. v. Ward, that allude to the fact that in evaluating how a civil case compares to a criminal case, the state's penalties or the government's penalties are like damages. They're the government or the public's way of collecting damages for injuries. I think these cases are helpful. They're not directly on point.
Let me ask you another hypothetical. I'm trying to extrapolate, seeing where this might lead us, and I can tell you that's one of my concerns. Let's say that there are two farmers that have side-by-side properties, and one farmer uses some kind of pesticide on his farm, and that pesticide goes into the other farmer's property, and the other farmer isn't particularly paying attention to his fields for 5-10 years, and all of a sudden tries to plant something and finds that in fact he can't grow something because of the chemical damage done by the neighbor, so that he discovers it at that point, and any negligence statute is long run. Under your theory, that farmer could sue 15 years later for the negligent act of the farmer, couldn't it?
Well, under my theory, if the first farmer violated the law, and if the state
had... Well, he was negligent. Aren't you asking?
If the discovery rules were to apply to this private tort action, sure, the first farmer would be negligent. But if the discovery rule were to be applied to a state enforcement action, then it would apply.
We can say that the state can enforce, have the discovery rule applied to property damage, but not a personal individual? Can we make that distinction? I mean, you're asking for an extension not only in terms of a forfeiture action, but also property damage. And my question is, can we simply say that if the state is the party, that it can be extended for property damage, but not for a private individual?
I think I understand what you're saying. I think that if the injury is to the state and to the public, then the discovery rule should apply. I think it also applies to the private individual under Hansen,
even though it's property damage.
Thank you.
Ms. Hirsch, your time is up.
Thank you.
And you do get the rebuttal.
Yes, I will.
Correct. Ms. Eccleston?
Thank you. Good morning. Ms. Hirsch's argument related to what Chrysler did back in 1970. My argument relates to what it did not do after 1978. The state's second claim in this case involves Section 144.76 of the statutes. That statute requires that any person who possesses or controls a hazardous substance which is discharged, or who causes the discharge of a hazardous substance, shall take the actions necessary to restore the environment to the extent practicable and minimize the harmful effects from the discharge to the air, lands, or waters of the state. This law was enacted in 1978. It has recently been renumbered as Section 292.11, sub 3. Chrysler maintains that the state cannot enforce Section 144.76 against it because this would constitute an impermissible retroactive application of the law in violation of the ex post facto clause of the Constitution. The fundamental flaw in Chrysler's argument is that it is not Chrysler's pre-1978 unlawful conduct, its unlawful waste disposal activities, on which its liability under Section 144.76 is based, but its post-1978 failure to act to remedy the post-1978 hazardous substance discharges at the Bark River site. When Section 144.76, which is commonly called the Spills Law, was enacted in 1978, Chrysler's drums of waste were buried on the Bark River property, discharging hazardous substances into the environment, the soil and the groundwater. Because Chrysler did nothing to abate those discharges, they continued for 15 years. Chrysler's failure to take abatement action after 1978 caused continuing discharges within the meaning of the spills law and make Chrysler liable under that law for both injunctive relief and civil forfeitures.
I need some clarification. If there had not been an alleged violation by giving this product to an unlicensed transporter, assuming it was given to a licensed transporter, would you still be here on your second claim?
Yes.
Would you still be here on your first claim?
No. Chrysler maintains...
I'm sorry. And that's because the first claim deals really with the... That's what the first claim is. The first claim is you violated the law because you gave this product to an unlicensed transporter. Had
right.
you given it to a licensed transporter, we wouldn't be prosecuting you and asking for penalties.
Right.
And under the spills law, you're dealing with... if I may, more remediation. That is, you contaminated the property, now you have to clean it up.
Yes.
Am I correct in that?
Yes, you are. That's exactly right. Chrysler maintains that this case is not about whether it can be held liable under the law for remediation of the site, but only about whether it can be made to pay forfeitures. The state submits that this case and this claim, the spills law claim, is about both injunctive relief and forfeitures, and that the two are inseparable. Either Chrysler is liable under 14476 sub 3 or it is not. If it is not, then it is liable for neither injunctive relief, cleaning up the site, nor forfeitures. Chrysler dismisses the state's request for injunctive relief, claiming that it has already engaged in a site cleanup. And indeed, it is engaged in that cleanup. But as the record shows, it has not completed that remediation. And if Chrysler is correct that Section 14476 cannot be applied to it, then the state would be powerless to compel it to complete that remediation if it should decide to discontinue this very expensive undertaking. The state would, under Chrysler's interpretation of the spills law, be similarly powerless to compel other similarly situated responsible parties to act.
Was this cleanup started simply as a voluntary act? Or it seemed to me there was some reference about some other lawsuit. And
there was a private lawsuit by the owner, the current owner of the property.
And was there, why did the cleanup start then? Was there an agreement in another lawsuit? Or?
I believe there was a settlement agreement which provided for the cleanup.
So it's the state position that it can't enforce that agreement, is that it?
I mean, we're not a party. Right, the state was not a party to that lawsuit and could not be.
Ms. Eggleston, am I incorrect that the remediation has been completed? I had the impression that the DNR had already certified the cleanup of this site.
DNR issued a certification letter, but it was a partial certification, and we supplemented the record to submit that letter because what it does is make clear that the DNR certified the removal of the waste and some other work on the site, but that the groundwater investigation and remediation is still ongoing. So it's not complete yet.
Is there a plume of a half a mile? Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And that's the part that is not taken care of?
Right. Correct. To allow Chrysler to apply the statute as it wants to would, or not apply it, I guess, would clearly be contrary to the purpose of the spills law, which, as this court indicated in the Mwathi case, is, quote, to prevent, minimize, and if necessary, abate and remedy contamination of the state environment and the resultant risks to human health caused by the discharges of hazardous substances. On the question of forfeitures, it does appear that the trial court was troubled less by the prospect of requiring Chrysler to take remedial action than it was by the prospect of assessing forfeitures. The state submits that this goes not to liability but to the amount of the forfeitures, a matter in which trial courts have considerable discretion. Forfeitures for violations of Section 14476, that is, failure by a responsible party to take remedial action, are found in Section 14499 of the statutes, which has now since been renumbered to Section 29299. The range is $10 to $5,000 a day, a pretty wide range, and within that, the trial court has discretion to assess forfeitures which reflect, among other things, the defendant's culpability. So if the defendant's blameworthiness is low, given the circumstances surrounding the violation, then the forfeitures imposed can be reduced accordingly.
Let me ask you, this law is basically a strict liability law, is that right?
It is.
There's no requirement that the state have to show that, in fact, Chrysler A even knew that the barrels were put on this property.
Right.
And the law then requires that if it is participating or in some manner, and that's of course that is an issue what the participation is, but participating in it, that it is liable both for the forfeitures and the cleanup.
Yes.
And there's no requirement of any knowledge in order to assess forfeitures?
Right. That's our position. Chrysler acknowledges that forfeitures are meant to act as a deterrent, but it argues that there can be no deterrent effect for the acts of long-gone employees. What Chrysler ignores is that forfeitures are meant to act as a deterrent not only to this violator, this defendant, but to others similarly situated, and to create a disincentive to the mismanagement of hazardous substances and prevent discharges to the environment and the resultant threat to human health. Waste generators are liable under Section 14476 when their waste mismanagement results in hazardous substance discharges, which continue unabated. This is so even absent any post-1978 conduct on their part, for as this court held in the Mothy case, Section 14476 applies to current discharges without any requirement that there's a current human activity. The outflow of contaminants, said the court, is a discharge without regard to human activity, and liability can therefore be based on inaction where action is required.
Let me ask you a follow-up question on that. So it's my understanding the state's position is, even if this had been given to a licensed hauler, and the hauler had put it in what fell the spot at the time and was a legal place, and Chrysler never bothered checking on it every 10 years to make sure it was fine, and had no knowledge where it was not on its own property, just never saw it anymore. Once that started leaking, Chrysler undertook some liability under the statute.
That's right. We believe it applies in that fashion, and that the whole question of culpability, whether the conduct was legal or illegal at the time and the rest of the...
Or whether it knows where it is or doesn't know where it is.
That all goes into forfeiture discretion. For these reasons, we respectfully request that the court reverse this decision below, dismissing the state's hazardous substance discharge claims against Chrysler.
Thank you, Ms. Edelston. Representing Chrysler Outboard Corporation is Stephen Cole and Mr. Blum.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. Attorney Mark G. Blum, Demeyer Rowley and Moody, SC of Waukesha, appearing on behalf of Chrysler Outboard, now known as Beaver Dam Products. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Cole, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of Chrysler.
Mr. Cole, a member of the State Bar?
No, he is not, Your Honor, but there has been an order pro hoc that has been entered by this court.
Right.
Permitting
Thank
the
you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for allowing me to appear here on behalf of Chrysler Corporation. This case is not about the state of Wisconsin's ability to get industry.
Mr. Cole, I would suggest that you might want to raise the podium so that we can hear you better.
Thank you. This case is not about the state of Wisconsin's ability to obtain relief from industry to remediate historic problems that have been created in the state. What this case is about is the sovereign's ability to impose punitive sanctions in light of the state statute of limitations with regard to state actions for forfeitures and penalties, and in light of the spill law. If this court upholds the state's position, Chrysler Outboard becomes liable potentially under the spill law for approximately $27 million in penalties that accrued from 1978 through 1993 for not addressing the conditions at the so-called Bark River site. It is liable because of acts that were undertaken by the entity 8 years before that statute became effective. And it is liable for those potential penalties in spite of the fact that Chrysler Outboard has been and is continuing to remediate the site, which the state does not question. In addition, the state is liable for separate violations asserted to have occurred in 1970 under NR 151.05 for handling waste off to an unlicensed transporter.
Do you have any objection if allegedly every day is a continuing violation, and that's, you know, asserted in the law, that you just be held liable and have exposure for the violations within the last 10 years?
Yes, we do, because of how we think the spill law should be applied. We also do from the standpoint that we don't believe that the discovery rule allows the continuing running of the statute, and that where the continual accrual should allow the continual accrual of those penalties over a 10 or 15 or 20 year time period.
But why doesn't it make sense to extend the discovery rule to this situation, in your opinion?
Contrary to the state's assertion, this is not, we're not talking about injury and compensation for injury. The injury is obviously the contamination of the environment, which is being remediated. That is a compensatory aspect, if you will, of how the environmental laws approach these situations. What the state is seeking is punitive sanctions. And that is far afield from the notion that this court accepted in the tort cases and extending the discovery rule to tort cases of compensating a tort victim for an injury.
Now, this is a forfeiture, isn't it?
This is
not. That's civil.
It's a civil penalty action. It's not a criminal action,
right,
admittedly.
So you'd have to show that it's punitive in nature to make the argument you're making, because it's civil.
It's civil, but it's penalties. There's no necessity under the statute for the court in assessing a penalty between $10,000 or $5,000 per day or per event, as it may be applied, or the state showing that there's any correlation between the amount to be assessed and what the unknown or uncompensable injury may be in the general interest of the public.
That would be up to the trial judge when there's an assessment. You can say, well, we're going to assess you these forfeitures based on how much there can be remediation and how much we have to put for future potential damages that you haven't remediated.
There is nothing in the statute which dictates that that's how the judge should approach the assessment of the penalties.
But it's one way, isn't it?
It's certainly one way that an individual circuit judge could approach the situation.
Can you answer me the question of if the state were not to prevail here, is there a way for them to ensure and to force Chrysler to make sure that the remediation is completed?
Yes.
And how is it?
CERCLA, Federal Superfund Law.
And has there been CERCLA action on this site also?
No, there isn't. There's been no need. The remediation is ongoing.
Mr. Cole, what is Chrysler doing about the half-mile plume in regard to the groundwater?
That's being addressed. I'm not involved in the technical side of this, and that is being handled by the entity and the WDNR.
But it's your knowledge that they are addressing the issue?
Yes. And the partial closure was an indication from the WDNR that the source area, the soils, had been adequately remediated. And as the state has indicated, these drums have long been removed.
Can you tell me, is this settlement something that is filed and turned into a judgment in court somewhere, or is it a private agreement between the parties?
I was not involved in the original activity, so I cannot tell you.
Let's assume that I take a highly dangerous chemical substance that is in three or four paint cans in my garage. I take them to my neighbor's property and I bury them in the middle of the night. And that's not discovered for 20 years. But when I did it today, it was clearly an illegal act. My neighbor one day discovers this and finds out that his property has been severely injured. It's unusable. As I understand your argument, you're saying that there is no redress against me.
Not at all. My argument is confined solely to the state's ability to seek redress, not for an injury to the state, but for punitive sanctions. Here they are seeking specifically penalties for violation of a regulatory statute in 1970.
That's what I'm saying. You're saying that I cannot, the state could not enforce a forfeiture action against me from the act that I did yesterday.
No more
anything. I mean that I did one day and it wasn't discovered for 20 years.
No more so than I'm, not being a Wisconsin lawyer, I'm not sure what your statute of limitations is on certain criminal acts.
Mm-hmm.
But I assume there is one. No more than you can prosecute a criminal act after the statute of limitations.
What about the remediation aspect of it?
I think
that's not punitive.
No, that's not. That's admittedly not punitive.
So are you objecting to the remediation damages that they're requesting here?
Well, the injunctive relief?
Mm-hmm.
We don't think the injunctive relief is available because we don't believe the spill law applies to us.
Why not?
Because the spill law, by its terms, and the state has time and again attempted to assert that that spill law was enacted as a broad remedial statute by this legislature. If you look at the spill law and compare it to, let's say, CERCLA, where Congress clearly intended to have that statute address retroactively historic disposal sites, the language is entirely different. The spill law clearly, by its own terms, says after its effective date, a person who possesses or controls or causes the discharge of a hazardous substance has to clean it up. It's a very simple statute and has to report the spill to the WDNR. And this court in Malfi predicated Mr. Malfi's liability on a present discharge, under how the court construed discharge, and B, the fact that he was then presently in possession or control, and expressly stated and rebuffed Mr. Malfi's claims about ex post facto or impermissible retroactivity on the grounds that they were not addressing activity that occurred prior to the enactment of the spill law, the original dumping activity which Mr. Malfi and his company had done on the property.
So your position is you look to the date of the spill, the original spill.
Here, Chrysler Outboard's liability on the spill law, as the state clearly maintains in their briefing, is predicated upon activity in 1970. That's when the activity causing the, quote, discharge occurred. That activity predated the statute by more than 8 years.
So if Justice Babbage's example 20 years ago would have made it 1977, Justice Babbage would have no liability, right?
Under the spill law.
Under the spill law, he has no liability. And under your interpretation of the forfeiture law, he has no liability. He's off scot-free.
Under the spill law.
What about CERCLA?
No. But even CERCLA does not impose penalties retroactive for prior acts. CERCLA imposes penalties for not once you are subject to an EPA order or directive to address a site, which CERCLA renders you civilly liable for. Then you become subject to penalties if you disregard the EPA's orders.
So you think Chrysler isn't subject to this statute? At all.
No, I believe that Chrysler is not subject to the statute. The statute does not impose strict retroactive liability upon waste generators for disposal activities that occurred prior to its enactment.
You mentioned Matthew, and I understood Matthew to state that a statute imposing liability for hazardous discharges does not violate ex post facto where the action brought by the state related only to discharge from contaminated soil located on the defendant's property and did not relate to activities which took place on the property prior to the statute's enactment. The state is saying we're talking about this continuing and ongoing contamination.
There's two aspects. Why was Mr. Malfi responsible on the spill law? First instance, A, there was an ongoing discharge, as the court interpreted the word discharge in the statute. Secondly, he then presently possessed or controlled the property, i.e., the hazardous substances located on the property.
Well, that's the facts of Matthew, but that wasn't a controlled distinction.
Those were the two issues that the court specifically addressed. Can we hold the present owner liable as the present possessor or controller? And the court said yes.
Says, can the owner of property which contains contaminated soil from which hazardous substance is being discharged be required? I mean, so
yes.
That's the fact. It's the owner
yes.
of property. It doesn't say the owner can be, but a non-owner can't be. I mean, that's not the whole thing.
No, the court didn't address the situation. Obviously, the non-owner was not sued by the state in that case. The person or entity that had caused the original disposal.
So we don't have Mappy really addressing the issue here of whether a non-owner of property can be liable and is not, the prosecution of the statute is not defeated by ex post facto. Mappy dealt with a owner and said you're not defeated by ex post facto. It didn't deal with a non-owner. Is that correct?
It did not deal with a non-owner. But what I am saying is that with regard to Mappy, is that this court's interpretation of why Mr. Mappy was liable in that case is consistent with the concept that the spill law was enacted prospectively. It was not intended, and its language is not intended to operate retroactively. Right? We have rules of construction in the state that dictate that when the legislature uses the present tense, which it did, that statute is presumed to have prospective effect only. How can you read cause? How can you read possesses or controls, which are the liability provisions, as having a retroactive effect? Particularly when the further provisions of that statute require reporting of the event by the possessor or the controller or the causer within 24 hours after the spill incident. It is a very simple statute.
So when was the spill here?
When was the spill? Under the way that this court has interpreted discharge, the discharge occurred initially, presumably sometime during the 1970s, and continued on.
Okay, so why wasn't the spill in 1978, after the enactment of this law?
I think there was a discharge after the enactment of the law, as this court interpreted discharge. But that doesn't end the question. The question is, who's liable? And you're only liable if you cause the discharge, and that liability can only operate prospectively.
Well, statute responsibility 144.76 sub 3 doesn't say only if you caused it. It says a person who possesses or controls a hazardous substance which is discharged or who causes the discharge of a hazardous substance.
Yes, a possessor, a controller, or a causer.
So why aren't you a causer?
Well, this court has never defined what causation is.
Okay, now's a good time to do it. Why aren't you a causer?
The Keller Transit and the individuals at Keller Transit are the ones that caused the discharge, are the ones that dumped the material where they did. I would say that in the literal sense. If you want to broaden the causation and say that Chrysler Outboard somehow is in their role of causation, let's accept that for the sake of argument. The acts of causation by Chrysler occurred in 1970. 8 years before the spill law was enacted.
No causation after 1970.
It was a completed act. They ceased to have possession, control, or any ability to deal with the material.
Now these were in barrels, right?
Yes.
Whose barrels?
The barrels were, I believe, I don't know, they came from the plant.
Did you barrel the stuff? Chrysler barrel it?
I don't think the record tells us much about how the actual operations or accumulation of waste material occurred. Let me getting back to the statute of limitations issue for a moment.
I want to stay with the statute just for a second. I'm looking at the statute again. A person who possesses or controls a hazardous substance. Seems to me that the legislature wanted to say a person who owns the property, they could have. They didn't say it. They said a person who possesses or controls a hazardous substance, which is discharged. Why is your client not a person who controlled a hazardous substance?
We were a person who controlled a hazardous substance, but our act of control of that hazardous substance predated the spill law.
Well, it only predates it. I'm looking at Administrative Code 51051, which says a person shall be responsible. Again, that's the same section I was reading from responsibility under 144.76. They shall be responsible unless they make arrangements for this licensed transport.
And you didn't make arrangements for a licensed transport. So you are still in control, you are still responsible.
If you blend those two together.
If you want to interpret the statute that way, you can reach that. Yes. I'm saying that, you know, read the statute is straightforward. It is not a complex statute. And is it being made only complex because, understandably, the Wisconsin Attorney General wants to extend the reach of that statute? And I don't think that their place for that is here. Their place for that is in front of the legislature, saying, pass us a statute that creates retroactive liability and imposes remedial obligations akin to CERCLA. Not to create an artificial construction of what the plain language of the spill law is.
And what's the plain language you're relying on?
Possesses or controls or causes, which is prospective in language. It isn't a person who possessed or controlled or who caused a discharge. CERCLA says that a person who arranged for disposal or who transported or who owned or operated a site of disposal is liable.
You're saying you didn't cause the spill?
I'm not saying that we didn't in the broadest sense cause the spill, to the extent that they allege that we caused the spill, though the causation predated the spill law. And we are not liable, therefore, under the spill law because it was enacted 8 years after the fact.
Well, if I bury a can that's got a slow drip on it, are you saying that I'm only liable on the date that I buried the can and not for the dates that follow in which the slow drip occurs?
I think that that's the fair reading of that spill law statute. It's intended to address a spill.
Yes.
It was extended in Mouthy to address a disposal and remediation of a disposal site. But if you read that statute as it was enacted, that statute is intended by the legislature to address a spill.
Well, but just as Babbage's can, which he put in 20 years ago, was just in great shape, it didn't start to spill until 10 years ago. Now, that's after the statute was enacted.
And if I'm no longer in possession or control of that can, then I'm not liable under the spill.
That's right. He's not in possession or control. In fact, he's a trespasser. He trespassed. And he doesn't have control, but he doesn't have possession, but he sure caused that spill. He caused it by putting in a barrel. And that barrel didn't start to leak until 10 years ago, and when it started, it was okay.
It deteriorated over time.
Yeah, sure.
I'm accepting that. If you did it before the spill law was enacted, you're not liable. If you did it after the spill law was enacted, you are liable.
Well, you sure want to make him liable, don't you?
I sure want to.
Want to make him liable.
Bad guy.
Why shouldn't he bear the responsibility of his evil acts?
Why should he?
Yeah.
Because if the legislature said he should, then he should.
Okay.
That's why I pay my taxes.
Mr. Cole, let me ask you about the corporation itself. It's my understanding this corporation is now Beaver Dam. Is that merely a name change, or
it's merely a name change. The actual plant, the facility, has been sold, I think, three times since Chrysler Outboard owned it. And that goes to the part of the policy issue on the statute of limitations for violation. The state wants a discovery rule, discovery of the violation rule adopted by this court, which would, in this instance, allow the state 25 years after the fact to bring a punitive action. Now, you bring a punitive action for penalties, for retribution, and for deterrence. With regard to retribution, with respect to a corporate entity, and in this instance of this corporate entity, employees who did it are no longer around. Management who did it are no longer around. The shareholders of the entity may be entirely different. So you're visiting upon, from the standpoint of an entity, yes, the same entity, but from the standpoint of persons within that entity who acted, we're long gone. There's no, you're not visiting retribution upon the parties or the management responsible 25 years after the fact. From the standpoint of deterrence, to prosecute this claim 25 years after the fact, when we now have a whole plethora of regulatory statutes in place that change completely the social and legal climate in which we deal with hazardous waste, and to say that that's going to deter others presently, when we have entirely different statutes that are enforceable now, like RCRA and the state's equivalent? That's not deterrent. That's not going to deter anybody.
What's wrong with the state's argument that this really is not punitive, that it's really a payment to the public for the public's damage suffered by the public's environment?
They cite no case law in Wisconsin that stands for that proposition, and the case law that they cite from the United States Supreme Court is completely an opposite. There the court was dealing with issues such as when can we obtain civil relief and also criminal prosecution.
This strikes me as so very analogous to that, counsel, to a personal injury that has not been discovered. The doctor leaves the sponge inside my stomach, and I don't discover it until 10 years later. Now, clearly I've been injured, and under our tort law, we say that the statute of limitations does not begin to run until I've discovered that injury. Now, here, there has been an injury. At least I'm assuming there has been an injury. Now, the state can't sue for pain and suffering, and the can't sue for medical damages, etc., but they do have forfeiture available to them, which seems somewhat analogous to the kind of rights that I would have in a tort action.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Please. Yes.
There is no prerequisite for injury to have their claim for penalty for violation of the statute. That's not an element of a cause of action. Their cause of action is if you violated such and such rule, such and such statute, we have a claim for civil penalties against you, irrespective of whether or not that violation resulted in any sort of tangible injury. Injury is not an element of a cause of action.
So what you're saying is that if this had been the cleanest stuff in the world and it caused nobody any problem at all, the state, you're saying the state still says that you can be prosecuted or forfeiture.
Sure. Whether they would or not, I suppose, is another question. But if you adopt the rule in this case of a discovery violation, it's not going to be restricted to environmental circumstances. It's going to apply across the board. Why wouldn't it? If this court adopts a rule that a cause of action for a violation of a regulatory provision accrues when the state discovers it. And then we're down a slippery slope. Because unlike the tort claim, where you can fairly easily ascertain when that claimant knew or reasonably should have known that they'd been injured, when there was a manifestation of latent injury, and what state steps that individual undertook to determine who was responsible. Unlike that kind of individual tort claim, we're dealing with the bureaucracy of the sovereign. And 25, 30 years, 40 years after the fact, is there going to be anybody around with living memory that's going to know whether or not Mr. John Smith, who was a WDNR local district officer, knew about something and never wrote it down?
Isn't that the very same argument and the very same policy considerations that we looked at in Hansen? Now, setting aside the penalty provisions, just with regard to the remedial action, it seems to me that the policy reasons behind the application of the discovery rule in Hansen also apply with equal force, at least to the remedial claims here.
Perhaps to the remedial, but not to the punitive claims. Because what Hansen has predicated is giving the tort victim an opportunity to have their day in court for compensation.
That's right. When there has been, in fact, Hansen says it is manifestly unjust for the statute of limitations to begin to run before a claimant could reasonably become aware of the injury.
But when we start talking about giving the state the opportunity to impose punitive sanctions and the abuse of the sovereign could possibly make of that,
do you concede then the same policy reasons given for the application of discovery rule in Hansen apply with equal force to the remedial claims in this case?
It could. And many courts have recognized in some of the cases that we've cited, it made the distinction between circumstances where equitable relief is being sought and not running afoul of the statute of limitations, or even saying it's an equitable action not subject to statute of limitations because they're legal, and make a distinction between that and an action seeking penalties, which is an action at law. And the bottom line here is that, as 3M notes, since the beginning of this country, The consistent law of this country has been that a cause of action for a violation giving rise to penalties accrues as of the date of the violation. As observed by our Supreme Court, the irony would be that if you adopt a discovery of violation rule, you would have a longer statute of limitations for a civil penalty than you have for treason in this country. And that is putting tremendous power and the ability to use that power in the hands of the sovereign. And that's what the state is asking you. And the state is not like the hapless tort victim who cannot control their destiny in large measure. If the state wants to have a different standard with regard to its enforcement of its regulatory laws, it can enact a different statute of limitations. It can enact a discovery rule if it wishes. Furthermore, if the state wants to be able to timely detect violations of its regulatory laws, it can enact reporting requirements. It can enact auditing requirements. Any number of regulatory requirements to assure the timely detection of violation of its laws. And many statutory regulatory enactments contain those kinds of provisions. So the state is in the position to protect itself, unlike the tort victim. And that, again, I think is a very fundamental policy distinction. Finally, with regard to the spill, I think there is a problem if you, let's assume that you elect to apply the spill law retroactively. There is then an ex post facto problem to the extent that you seek to impose punitive sanctions. And that's different and distinct from the ability to obtain injunctive relief. Now, we maintain that that can be avoided completely by reading the statute by its plain terms, which is that it has prospective operation. If the legislature wants it to apply to historic generators, they can amend it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hirsch.
There are just a few places in which Ms. Eggleston and I disagree with Mr. Cole. First of all, his figure of $27 million for forfeitures, I believe he's looking at the maximum forfeitures there. For both the penalties that apply to the violations of the law in 1970, as well as the penalties that apply to spills law, carry a range of $10,000 to $5,000 per violation. So it is within the discretion of the court to go anywhere within that range of $10,000 to $5,000. It is also my understanding that federal CERCLA law only allows the state to recover its costs after the state has funded a cleanup. I do not believe federal CERCLA law allows the state alone to order a cleanup. I think EPA can do that. We believe that the spill continues today, that the contaminants are still discharging today, and that the contaminants were discharging in 1978 and have been discharging since 1978. They are Chrysler's contaminants. Chrysler has violated the spills law not because of what it did in early 1970, but because it has failed to remediate since 1978. We also disagree about what this case is about. It is about remediation. But for an application of the discovery rule to Claim 1, the state has no ability to compel Chrysler to clean up. And but for your application of the spills law, the state has no ability to compel Chrysler to clean up under the spills claim. We're asking...
But you're asking for more than remediation. You're asking for civil sanctions.
We are.
Punitive sanctions. And that, of course, was a very interesting part of your opponent's argument. No, there's no injury here. You know, you could be, whether there's injury or not, you're saying we can go back 25, 30 years, 50 years.
And get
forfeitures.
That's accurate. We're asking this court to allow us...
Why is that fair?
It's fair because Chrysler violated the law in the early 70s. And because as a result of their violation, not as a result of an act of God or anything else, but because of the way they violated the law, the evidence of that violation, the injury, has been buried for 20 years. Should they be allowed to avoid liability for their violations because they buried
What if I commit a criminal act 25 years ago and go bury the gun?
Again, it is true...
And then the statute of limitations has run.
It is true that there is a punitive component to our enforcement statutes. But these are civil penalties. There is no possibility of jail time here. And we believe these facts make this case more like a tort than a crime. This is more akin to the tort scenario.
Millions of dollars in forfeitures is pretty punitive, it seems to me, just because you don't throw them in jail.
It doesn't have to be millions of dollars. It could be as little as $10 per violation. I think the fact that this occurred in 1970 and whatever that means might go to the weight of deciding how much forfeitures to pay. We're asking you to treat the state...
You indicated just a couple minutes ago that it's your position that the spills continue today. And I'm curious about that because it's my understanding that the barrels have been removed. It's my understanding that the ground itself has been certified as cleaned up by the DNR. How do you claim that the spills continue today?
The certification, which is a letter, and I think it's Exhibit 26, is a partial certification, and groundwater contamination continues to spread until it's cleaned up.
Okay.
The groundwater contamination...
Yeah, the contamination continues, but how does the spill continue? That was your term. Are you claiming the discharges continue?
Yes. I'm claiming that the groundwater... That Chrysler's contaminants are continuing to discharge and spew under the ground, and that's what makes the groundwater contamination plume continue to travel.
If there was no groundwater contamination, you think it could still be fair? If whatever they buried was totally non-toxic, totally lacking in harm to anybody, you still say we could go back 25, 30 years and nail them?
If there's no injury...
If there
is no injury to be discovered, if it was simply a failure to know about a violation, no.